From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, the 4th of February 2020. I had to think about that for a minute. And here we are the morning after the Iowa caucuses, which I guess have turned out to be somewhat of a rockin' mess. Nobody knows who won the Iowa caucuses yet. And we'll be talking about that in just a few minutes with John Margolis, a longtime political writer, a former Chicago Tribune Newsday writer. He's been to Iowa and I think covering a few of the caucuses over the years. So we'll be finding out from John a little bit about what he thinks might have happened. And then in the second half hour, we're going to be speaking with Major Corinne Wegener. She is speaking at Norwich University this evening, and she is going to be talking about preserving cultural artifacts in wartime. She actually was in charge of that for the U.S. forces in Iraq during the Iraq War of 10, 15 years ago. And, of course, that became an issue about a month ago now when President Trump was saying he might be bombing some Iranian cultural sites. And so we're going to find out a little bit about what the military thinks about and tries to do when it is waging warlike activities in places where there are historic sites and so on that people want to protect. I think that's an interesting topic, and we'll be hearing about that in the second half hour. Later on, our good friend Dan Richardson makes a return engagement here on the Dave Graham Show. He, of course, is our legal analyst, very active attorney in Montpelier, former president of the Vermont Bar Association. He's got a couple of Vermont Supreme Court cases recent that he is thinking about telling us a little bit about. And as well, I may be asking to get his thoughts, his latest thoughts on the conduct of the impeachment trial, a trial without witnesses and a trial without documentary evidence in the Senate. A rather interesting approach, shall we say. And so we'll be hearing from Dan Richardson about that in the second hour of the program. But let's start out with John Margolis. He is writes a political column these days for vtdigger.org and has quite a pedigree of national political correspondence in his career. And John, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And so I'm just curious to find out your first thoughts now. The Iowa caucuses seem to have gone off a little more shakily than usual, shall we say.
Well, quite a bit more shakily than usual, but we know who won.
We know who won.
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Donald Trump won the Iowa so far. Now, presumably results will be announced today. There's a limit as to how incompetent any group of people can be, and I think that they will announce the results today. And when we get the results, I think people will start looking at the results, and the debacle of last night will not have too lasting an impact on the race, although it may have a lasting impact on the Iowa precinct caucuses and whether they will survive as a first-in-the-nation tradition and something that cannot be tampered with. I think it may very well be tampered with.
Yeah, but, I mean, there are a couple of interesting things going on here. You mentioned Donald Trump being the winner. Now, he's been declared the winner, from what I understand, of the Republican caucus, right?
By 90-some percent, yes.
Yeah, so that's not...
But he's also the winner because the Democratic Party in general, although it's really only the Iowa Democratic Party, looks incompetent. And I believe Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out something, and these people want to run your health care system. Well, of course, the government sort of already runs the health care system, but politically, that's a potent argument. This does look like people don't know how to tie their own shoelaces, and they can't do... Do you want to trust them to do anything very much more complicated?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, I've watched the Iowa caucuses over the years from afar. I've never actually gone out there to cover them myself, but I sometimes just sort of scratch my head and say, you know, is this a really a reliable system here where you have people who go basically stand in the corner of a school gymnasium in line with the person they are supporting, and then you and then people can sort of do this horse trading. If you're the person you're supporting isn't deemed viable right off, then you can go to somebody else, and you're going to get heavily lobbied by people representing other candidates and so on and so forth. And it just seems like, you know, compared to the when I think about voting, it's a fairly quick but also rather formal and strictured process, where you go to the voting booth and you're in secret. You're not supposed to have other people sort of knowing who you're supporting, and you you cast your ballot and put it in the machine, and that's that.
Well, that's absolutely true, and it's also very you get much lower turnouts for caucuses. You have 1.5 million or so people who voted in 2016 in Iowa. You have 600 and some thousand registered Democrats. Unlike Vermont, it's a party registration state. Mm-hmm. You get, and it looks like we're getting fewer than 200,000 to go to the caucuses. They're saying that it seemed to be in line with last time, 2016. The big turnout was 2008, when you had well over 200,000 people. So the turnout is much smaller. You're right, and it's open. It's not a secret ballot. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, number one, my view always was, this is up to the people of Iowa. You know, who am I to tell them how to choose their delegates? And it just, in law, every state may choose its own method for the way it selects convention delegates. And also, having been to a few of them, they're kind of fun. And they are a very grassroots spectacle of ordinary people coming together in their neighborhoods or their town gymnasium, you know, the school cafeteria or gym or the Elks Club headquarters in a small town. It's farmers, factory workers, school teachers, cops, small business people. They get together, they express themselves, they do a little horse trading with the candidates that the supporters of people who don't get to the 15%. So it's kind of a very inspiring, almost spectacle of democracy in action, except it isn't all that democratic, in addition to the criticism that Iowa is 90-some% white. The entrance polls last night showed that 53% of the caucus goers were college graduates. Now, something like 30% of Americans over 25 are college graduates. I assume it's a little higher in Iowa, which has a very large and high quality public university and college system, but it's not anywhere close to 53. So it is something of a, you know, it's people who can afford to get active and participate. You have to take a whole evening off. If you got to get up early in the morning and go to a job that requires physical energy, you're less likely to go. So the factory worker, the construction worker, the person who stands behind a counter all day, is not that those people don't go, but they're less likely to go.
Yeah.
So your elite, you know, professional people who work, who have a job where they sit, like me and you,
uh-huh.
You sit down someplace that's cool in the summer and warm in the winter, and you don't have to lift heavy objects, are more likely to go. So in that sense, it's less democratic, although once you get there, it's democracy in action.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you said, who are we to try to tell Iowa how to do its voting or whatever? And as far as that goes, I agree. I will say, though, that I'm not sure that there's any requirement that the rest of the country has to pay attention.
Let it go first and continue to. That's right. But yeah. That's up to the parties.
Yeah.
You know, again, in our system, we don't do this by federal law. We could. I'm not even sure we could. You get into an interesting constitutional question. The parties, both of them, lead, but the Democrats took the lead in this making the rules, have just decided to let Iowa and New Hampshire have this primacy. And I think Iowa's position is now threatened because of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think their case was already, frankly, somewhat weak.
Yes,
and this doesn't help it. That is very true. And you know, I think in the case of the Iowa caucuses, You know, the whole system has been a little bit shaky in the past, actually. Mitt Romney was declared the winner of the Iowa caucuses. I think it was it in 2012, I believe, when he
that
ended up getting the nomination. But then it emerged like 16 days later after Romney carried this big momentum through New Hampshire and I think South Carolina. After Romney really got a big boost out of "quote unquote" winning the Iowa caucuses, it was determined that Rick Santorum actually had won, right?
Yeah, by a slight. They said Romney had won by 8 delegates, not voters, and it turned out that Santorum had really won by a somewhat larger margin, not big, but larger. And if he had taken that, I don't think Santorum would have won New Hampshire anyway. But who knows? If you take that, and one of the problems with last night with this debacle is nobody carries momentum into New Hampshire this morning, although we do know, we sort of know, and we should be very careful, but we do seem to know that Joe Biden did not do well. And I, you know, assuming it does come out fairly within the next several hours, that could hurt him. And we do seem to know that Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, Buttigieg did very well, and that Klobuchar did much better than expected, as she put it, punched over their weight. And so that could provide them with a little momentum if that turns out to be confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, although the whole situation there is so sort of muddled and tainted by muddling, I would say that helps to sort of minimize the momentum, doesn't it?
It diminishes it, and we'll see. You know, we live in such a fast-changing world. Today, this morning, I saw a little television, I read a little of the newspaper, the sort of analysis was, well, it was such a mess that nobody's, excuse me, nobody's going to be helped even if they end up winning. I'm not sure that's true because we will, as I said, I think, get results within the next few hours, and then attention will go on to those results in the media, online. Another interesting thing that came out of the entrance poll, 80% of the people don't tweet. Most people don't tweet. Why we pay attention to Twitter, which I don't even do, is one of the great mysteries of modern life. But I'll tell you what is disturbing for the Democrats.
Yep.
And again, this is preliminary. If the turnout was only about as much as 2016, which was slightly under 200,000, what happened to this huge throng of people who were so upset at the Trump presidency that they're going to be active in trying to end it? And especially for Bernie Sanders, his claim is, I can get nominated and I can win because I'm going to bring into the process people who have not been part of the process because they haven't been satisfied with what the candidates have been saying. That does not seem to have happened.
Well, I think in fairness to Sanders, though, I don't know that a caucus is really the best test because you've got to kind of be as you mentioned, it's a tiny slice of a slice of a slice of the population.
That's a good point. But still, he went out there and spent millions of dollars. He has.
Oh, yeah.
And put together this staff. Why couldn't they have gotten as many people to come to the caucuses as came for Barack Obama in 2008? So you're right. You can't compare it to a primary, but you can compare it to the earlier caucuses.
Yeah.
And they didn't do all that well, if that preliminary estimate turns out to be correct.
Yeah, and I actually, who really knows at this point? I mean, I hope that your confidence that there's going to be some kind of result announced later today is not misplaced.
It could be. We have no idea what's going to happen. But there is apparently a paper trail, and apparently also almost in almost every precinct, people photographed the collection of people of caucus goers who gathered for each candidate.
Yep.
So you could go, it all can be confirmed or refuted with a fair amount of certainty. And that, you know, there's no fraud going on here. There's no rigging, although I see the Republicans, the Trump campaigners are already saying, well, maybe the whole thing is rigged. These people, you don't have the power to rig it. There's no motivation to rig it. They're just, in this case, they were incompetent. They would have been incompetent had they tried to rig it, but there's no reason to think that they did.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just, the other weirdness about this is that last night, as they were sort of doing some interim counts and so on, I remember there were a couple of precincts where one candidate won like 2/3 of the vote in the precinct, and then the delegates were going to be divided up evenly, like between three top candidates, each getting two delegates.
Yes.
And I'm saying to myself, that doesn't seem quite right. What's up with that?
Well, that's what happens. You have the first count. Then all the candidates, probably Yang, and there still is some, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard is still in the race, and she had a few people. When their candidates were not viable in that caucus, they could either go home, or they could go to one of the viable candidates. So one of the other groups. So in the second, what you're talking about was the first vote. The second count was closer, and that's what the delegate apportionment is based on the second count after the caucus goers whose candidate was not viable, did not get 15%, took themselves to another part of the room to join a viable candidate. So I know the one you're talking about, it was Iowa City, not Iowa City, Ames, that's where Iowa State is. And it was a very pretty pro-Sanders academic area. So Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg. So what apparently happened was that most of the Yang and whoever else, Gabbard and other people whose candidacies were not viable, more of them went not to the Bernie Sanders part of the room, but to the Buttigieg or Warren part of the room. So the second count was much closer.
Yeah.
And the delegate apportionment was in accordance in proportion to the second count.
Okay. Well, yeah, there's a lot of tea leaves to read in this process as well. And, so
correct.
I leave it to people who have been there and can understand this process maybe a little better than the members of the general public. I think a lot of Americans watch this thing and kind of go, huh? What?
Well, especially, here's an interesting thing. The rules were changed in large part in response to pressure from Sanders, from the Sanders campaign, who thought, and perhaps correctly, and in this case that you mentioned, this would be an example, that they did better in the initial raw vote than in the second count and in the delegate count. So they changed the rules in a few ways, and they decided this year to report all three counts. They didn't used to do that.
I see.
That's what made it more complicated, and then they did it, obviously, very, very badly. Apparently, they didn't do a run-through. They had an app that everyone was supposed to use. They didn't do a real training of how to use it. I mean, all these people are volunteers.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a private company that makes the app and does the system that the state party contracted with, but out in the hinterlands and even in the big cities, in the precincts, in all those meetings, these are all volunteers, and they probably are no more technologically competent than I am, which is very, very little.
Well, I mean, is this a win for Trump in just the sense that he's now able to wag his finger at the Democrats and
To win for a day or two. I mean, it's not it isn't going to have lasting impact, I don't think.
Yeah. Okay.
And whether the final count has lasting impact even through New Hampshire for the Democrats, we presumably will find out later today. If they don't do it later today, then it probably will have no impact at all. Except I think some of these people who are claiming that they did well have some, and as far as Bernie Sanders goes, I think it, again, this is very preliminary and kind of clutching at straws, and if I were editing myself, maybe I'd tell myself to shut up here, so everybody take this with a grain of salt. It looks like the results may be Sanders, Buttigieg, 1-2, 2-1. Big difference. Buttigieg will take a close second to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
that. Will Bernie take a, is it is good for him, for Sanders, a close second to Buttigieg, especially if Klobuchar also did well. That's a little cloudier for him if Buttigieg and maybe Klobuchar get some momentum going into New Hampshire. Sanders is ahead, but, you know, he's ahead with 25%. He won the thing by 60%. This is a very weak field of candidates.
Yeah. Yeah.
None of them is really a great candidate.
So let me shift gears for a moment. I just have a couple more minutes with you, John Margolis.
Sure.
And I wanted to ask you about the impeachment trial and sort of the way the thing is. I guess the climactic vote really came Friday when the Senate decided that it was not going to hear witnesses or look at documentary evidence. What do you think? How does this thing shape up for President Trump, for starters?
Well, he will. He's tonight. He's the State of the Union. I assume he will claim vindication.
Mm-hmm.
It's really short of vindication. I thought Senator Murkowski's statement was yesterday. It was very powerful. It was more powerful than Lamar Alexander, senator from Tennessee, the other day. He said what the president did was inappropriate. I forget her exact words. She's a fairly conservative Republican,
yeah,
but an independent thinker and a mainstream Republican. I don't think she's a great fan of the president, although I don't know that. But she was very strong, but that what he did was just terribly wrong, and he should not have done it, and that this was not the time to remove him from office because of that.
Mm-hmm.
He will claim vindication. He's a weak candidate, too. He's the only president in the history of polling, and probably of history, if we'd had polling in the John Adams administration in the, say, 1790s, that never had 1 month where his approval rating was above his disapproval rating. We are in a period where a lot of weak candidates, two guys, now maybe three with Bloomberg, who are too old. I can say that because I'm their age, and I'm too old to be president.
Uh-huh.
I've covered the White House. President is a hard job. And one guy who's too young, and some people who, you know, they're all, no character flaw here. They're all admirable, decent people, but none of them is a terribly good candidate, and including the incumbent, who got elected by essentially filling an inside straight, in poker terms, and might be able to do it again, but he's not strong, and this does not strengthen him, this whole impeachment business with the general public. It doesn't make the Democrats look good either, but it doesn't make the president look good.
Yeah, I mean, it's he'll be the only president ever to have run for re-election after being impeached. So that's a fairly
unique. That is correct.
Unique, that is correct. I don't know if that's a qualification or exactly what to call it, but and I guess I don't know. That's just it feels pretty weird to think that. That, you know, this is, and it's entirely possible that he could be reelected as an impeached president.
Yes, it is.
And so there you go. I guess that's the shape of things right now. I mean, it's sort of a lot of this. I mean, I don't have enough hair left to keep scratching my head as much as I have to. It's really kind of an odd world these days, and that's just one of its many, many odd features. And
I suppose people have always been able to say that, but I'm not arguing with you on that. It is an odd world. Politically, it may never have been odder. It's been worse.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It may never have been odder.
Yeah, I would agree that it has been worse, and there's definitely felt like graver dangers at our door, you know, when
yep.
we were fighting fascism in World War II and so on.
And now, fighting each other in the 1860s. So
there's that, too.
It has been worse.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's look at the bright side. But on the other hand, I don't know if it's been any weirder. I mean, it's just...
Perhaps not.
So, John, do you think that the... As the president runs for re-election, What's the Democrats' next move in Congress? Do they try to bring any more articles of impeachment? Do they just sort of drop it? Or do they, because I mean, well, you know, I mentioned on the show here, there's other stuff, you know, you'd think he's got this thing with paying off Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. He's got some alleged emoluments clause violations.
If the Supreme Court rules that he has to turn over his taxes, will he comply? Will he try to defy a judgment of the court? There are plenty of things. I have no power. But if I were giving them advice, I would advise them don't try to impeach anymore. But I think they are going, and there's no reason why they shouldn't continue to probe the president's behavior and to bring things to light. That would be, and if they do it in an intelligent, restrained manner, that could have an impact on what happens in November. If they appear to be going after every little, making much out of little, which they have a tendency to do, they can hurt themselves also.
All right. Well, it's I guess that is one way to leave it, and I appreciate it, John. You are your big clarifier here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, sir.
All righty. We're going to head into a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News in just a moment after I tell you, remind you, that is, about our podcast, the WDEVradio.com website. You can go there or follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit and you'll find a list of our recent shows by guests and by topic, and listen to it any time of day or night. It's a great thing about the internet. Thanks to the Warren Store, friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, for their sponsorship for our podcast. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks. Stay with us.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring. The aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air. The coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat. But we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and all sorts of strange things go on in the news these days. We have a presidential impeachment trial winding down. We have Iowa caucuses blowing up, and all sorts of things going sideways. Or maybe the Iowa caucuses are going sideways. Maybe they'll figure it out by this afternoon and make an announcement, and everybody will kind of get over the what would then be something like an 18-hour delay. And if there's one thing you just can't do is impose a delay on something when the entire national media are waiting for election results, and people on cable TV are left twiddling their thumbs. Oh, my word, what are we going to do? Anyway, I wanted to bring in another topic here. About a month ago or so, when the United States basically assassinated the Iranian general, and Iran was rattling its swords and threatening to retaliate against the United States, President Trump tweeted something about how he would target 52 Iranian cultural sites if in fact Iran retaliated against the United States. And then some folks pointed out that doing that is actually against the law. There's international law in that. It's actually a war crime to target cultural sites in historic sites, etc. And then a couple weeks later, I saw a notice from Norwich University in which they were going to be inviting a speaker to campus whose expertise is in guarding historic sites and cultural sites for the U.S. military, and had done this work in Iraq during that conflict there. Her name is Major Corey Wegener, and she is on the phone with us this morning. She's going to be giving a speech at Norwich, and we're going to find out a little bit about what the rules are from the perspective of somebody who actually has done this work of protecting cultural sites for the U.S. military. And Major Wegener, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And so let refresh me now. I was fishing around in my emails trying to remember exactly when and where the speech is, or the talk is you're going to be giving. Is that this evening?
No, it's tomorrow night. I hope not, because I won't be there.
Okay.
I'm coming in tomorrow, and okay. It's at Norwich University tomorrow evening.
Okay. And if I remember correctly, it is open to the public, and I think it's actually a rather fascinating topic. Certainly, there's a long history to this. People think about all the cultural treasures of Europe, which were either protected or not protected so well in World War II, and obviously some even older stuff resides in places like Iraq and Iran, going way back to Babylon and so on, and if not before. And so there's a lot of concern there as well. And do I have it right that it was basically your job to sort of keep track of this stuff during the Iraq War?
Well, maybe not to totally keep track of everything, because that would be a huge task, but I was part of the 352nd Civil Affairs Command. And during the invasion of Iraq, they were assigned to do the civil affairs tasks, sort of be the liaisons between the civil community and the military, working with the non-governmental organizations and international organizations in the area. And one of our teams has to do with cultural heritage protection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was assigned to that team. Actually, it was right after the looting of the Iraq Museum, and they pulled me from my normal civil affairs unit and sent me over to Baghdad to try and help with recovering objects for the museum and to recover from the damage.
I didn't recall the looting of the museum. Refresh us on the history lesson here.
So not long after the U.S. started doing their thunder runs into Baghdad and realized that they could probably take Baghdad pretty quickly, then actual instability in Baghdad started to build up, and there was rioting and looting. And one of the victims of that looting was the Iraq National Museum. And so even though the staff had tried to secure things and they put a lot of the most important collections in a secret storage location, there were lots of objects in the galleries that they were not able to move. And so those were vulnerable to looters, and a lot of things got smashed up and a lot of things were stolen.
Wow. That's a shame. And is there, what do you understand about people's motivation for doing that? Are they just kind of going wild, or is there actually some rational thinking here? Is this smashing the powers that be or something in a revolutionary fashion? Or what goes through the minds of the people who are actually in there smashing things in the museum?
Well, I think you just mentioned several of the possible motivations. After the investigation of the looting of the museum, it was determined that some of the looting was probably actually targeted. People knew that this instability could happen because there was, you know, the long buildup to the U.S. invasion, so people had an idea of what was going to happen. And so there may have been some planned looting, people who had some insider information about where important objects may have been stored and broke in to do that. There was also just general this idea that the museum was not really something that was the shared cultural heritage of the community, because it had been closed to Iraqis for a long time, for years and years, because of the international sanctions against Iraq and not really having the funding and the money to keep normal operations going. So it had been closed to the public, and there was a kind of a sense that that was, you know, particularly Saddam's place. And so I think there was that backlash against the government. And then also the general, you know, we see this in disaster situations around the world. They're, you know, in law enforcement people are busy with other things and life-saving, and then suddenly you have a situation where there's looting, you know. And we had the same thing after Hurricane Katrina and other disaster situations. So the bad actors take advantage of that moment and kind of cut loose.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, that's part of it, is that the civil order is pretty much under extreme duress in those situations. And so, you know, that's, as you say, the bad actors emerge, and it's too bad, but that's, I guess that's part of the way of the world. Now, are there still any items in particular that are sort of on a missing list or whatever from the Iraqi National Museum these years later?
Yeah, there are lots of you know, more than sort of 15,000 objects we think were missing. It was really difficult to tell exactly what was missing because some of the inventories were quite out of date. For, as I mentioned, the museum wasn't able to operate in a normal way. And so, you know, thousands of those objects are still missing. Lots of little ancient cylinder seals, which were sort of what ancient Mesopotamians used to put their signature across a piece of clay. Clay tablets, some of the really important objects and works of art that go all the way back to biblical times are still missing.
That's really tragic, but it's also, I mean, amazing when I think about the items that were there. What would you say? I mean, is there anything in particular that is, you know, sort of I don't know, famous or would get the headline in terms of a missing item or any big important recoveries made in these intervening years? Or
my favorite recovery that happened was the recovery of the head of Warka. It's a really famous thousands of year old sculptural head. It's the earliest known sculptural representation of a female face. It's the goddess Inanna. That goes way back in history, and it was a spectacular day. That piece was looted from the museum, and the law enforcement folks that we were working with, the military police and others, heard from some informants that they might know where it was, and in a pretty spectacular raid, they were able to recover that piece. And so that was, you know, that resulted in a really big news conference at the museum because it was one of the most important pieces that was lost and then recovered. It's in just about every art history 101 textbook in the world.
Wow. Was it recovered in Baghdad still?
Yep.
Huh.
Yep.
So, that must have been a good day for the folks involved, I would think.
That was a pretty darn good day, and the military police really took their job seriously to work alongside Iraqi forces and to take that back. So, it's one of the most spectacular. It's like the Mona Lisa of Iraq.
Really. Wow, that's huge then, and congratulations to the law enforcement folks involved in that recovery, because obviously, you know, some of these things, artworks go missing and they stay missing for decades or heaven knows centuries in rare occasions. It's a good story when you hear that something as valuable as the Mona Lisa to that culture there is restored to its proper place. And I mean, is it back in the Iraqi National Museum now?
Yep.
Wow. Good
Absolutely.
Work. Good work, people.
I know.
You know, were you directly involved in that yourself, or was
I,
that?
Only to the extent that I was the one that got the phone call from the MPs saying, hey, we think we have the head of Warka. What should we do with it?
Wow.
And I said, bring it on over, please.
Well, talk to me about that. It must have been, so you get this phone call from the MPs what was your sort of initial reaction or whatever?
Well, I was thrilled because, you know, we had this missing objects posters all over the city, and, you know, we were really working to get any clues about where things might be. The, you know, museum staff were frantic to find these things. And so when we got that phone call from the military police, and the guy's name was Captain Vance Cooner, I'll never forget, and I'm hoping that I get to see him again one of these days really soon. He said, we had this raid and we think we might have recovered the head of Warka. They were working kind of in the area, not too far from the museum. And, I said, well, where is it? Is it safe? Do you have it secured and everything? And he goes, oh, so that head, it's important, huh? And I said, oh yeah, it's like a masterpiece. And he said, well, then I'll tell the boys to stop tossing it around out back.
Oh, jeez.
And I was like stunned.
Yeah. No playing soccer with it, please, guys. You know, come on.
Yeah. He goes, relax, ma'am. It's in the safe.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to make arrangements for us to bring it.
Yeah. Well, did he get a promotion out of the deal? It seems like it would be a way to get ahead. Sorry,
well,
bad pun.
He got a promotion, he's an attorney and has been, you know, kind of, you know, very interested in this area. I see things about him from time to time, and I'm hoping that he will be able to work with us for the Monuments Men and Women program that we're working on now.
Yeah. Refresh us on the that was a big movie a few years ago, Monuments Men. You must have seen that.
Yeah, of course.
And refresh us on the story there, because it is a pretty cool story.
Well, the Monuments Men, that was their kind of a nickname for them. Their actual title was Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives Officers. They were teams put together starting in 1943, while World War II was going on,
mm-hmm.
and realizing that they had issues. The Allies needed some information about where cultural sites were as the invasion of Europe was about to go, take place.
Yeah.
And they wanted to be sure not to damage things whenever possible, because, you want to save the infrastructure. These are things that are important to the civilian communities that you're trying to come in and liberate. And so how to work with that. And they also knew that a lot of the treasures of Europe had been looted by the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out where that material was, what was happening with it. And as they were doing aerial bombing, how to take out the militarily significant infrastructure but save the civilian infrastructure. So they pulled together teams of people who were already serving in the military, but they had cultural heritage backgrounds, people mm-hmm. like James Rorimer, who was the curator of medieval art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, was serving as an infantry officer. They said, hey, okay, we need this guy. So there was a commission here in the United States called the Roberts Commission. It was headed up by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roberts. President Roosevelt had approved of this commission, and so it had several museum directors from around the country. And they had this committee that said, we know where our staff people are that are serving in the military, and they were able to pull them together, start to work on protective mapping, pointing out for military air bombing where these important sites were throughout Europe, and also to figure out how to actually attach these civil affairs personnel onto the divisions as they went forward in the taking of Europe, and so that they could advise the commanders on protection and recovery of cultural sites.
Wow. Again, that's it's just wonderful work, and what a positive story, human beings in the midst of something extreme like wartime are actually saying to themselves, we have to respect our cultural heritage here, and so much of what gets passed down from generation to generation and century to century is tied up in this stuff. And so appreciating that value and protecting that value is big tip of the hat from your local radio host here. And actually, talk to me about your own background, Major Corey Wegener. Do you have a background in art history or cultural studies of any kind that would lead you to get assigned to this team in Iraq?
I do. I have a master's degree in art history mm-hmm. and a master's degree in political science, which is a kind of a weird combination. And I was serving as a curator at the Minneapolis Institute of Art mm-hmm. for many years, but I had been in the military since high school. I enlisted right after high school, and then got my commission through ROTC
mm-hmm.
at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And I was in the Quartermaster Corps for a long time, and then I switched over to civil affairs right after the first Gulf War, because I thought it sounded really interesting, and I started working in that field. And my husband also is a civil affairs officer.
Mm-hmm.
And so civil affairs is where this responsibility for cultural heritage protection doctrinally has been since World War II. They have many other civil sector expert positions, like professionals dealing with rule of law and civilian infrastructure, healthcare. It basically goes back to the military governments that we had to run after World War II for the occupation of Germany, Italy, Japan, etc. And so civil affairs has had this task for cultural property protection as one of its mission sets ever since 1943. It's just that we didn't have a whole lot of them. I was one of the very few cultural professionals in civil affairs when the invasion of Baghdad happened. But I had been tasked to go to Afghanistan to do something completely different. And, you know, this is how the military works. Even today, you can get a little bit frustrated about, you know, we have experts in this, but of course we're going to send somebody who knows nothing about that and assign you to something else.
Yeah.
Luckily, it all worked out this time because I was pulled from the Afghanistan mission and sent to Baghdad to work with the 352nd.
Wow.
As part of the culture team.
Major Wigan, are you now retired or you're still active duty, or where are you in the military?
I'm retired, Dave.
Okay.
Retired from the Army Reserves.
Got it. Okay. Talk to me a little bit about this this news story that came out a month or so ago. This is, of course, the just after the attack that killed the Iranian general. Iran was expected, frankly, to do some kind of retaliation. And the president of the United States, Donald Trump, tweeted that if Iran did retaliate against the United States, that one likely outcome would be an attack by U.S. forces on 52 Iranian cultural sites, including some of the ones very, very important to that nation. And what was your initial reaction when you saw news about this?
Well, I have to say I was a little bit surprised because I've been working for a long time to help raise awareness of the 1954 Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property during armed conflict. But I guess I wasn't overly concerned because, as we saw in the media, very quickly that was sort of walked back. I have every confidence that the Department of Defense follows the law of war, including the 1954 Hague Convention. And we've been working with colleagues there for a long time to help raise that awareness within the military as well. And so, it was a little bit surprising, but pretty quickly that came to be turned around in the media in the next couple of days.
Yeah, I guess not the first time we've seen things from the president that then sort of get walked back, especially when I don't know if the proper phrase is cooler heads prevail or something in the military and the national security leadership of the country. People gather around and sort of calm things down, I guess. So you expected that right from the very beginning of that whole episode?
Well, yeah. Actually, being a military veteran and knowing how much time and effort we spend on dealing with issues of the Geneva and Hague Conventions and the law of war and wanting to make sure that we are the most professional military in the world, right? And so knowing how much effort has been taken by our colleagues to make sure we have maps of all of these places and understand where the cultural sites are, teaching young soldiers, Marines, airmen, and Navy personnel about the Hague Convention and an understanding of that protecting civilians also means protecting the cultural heritage where they live and that they care about. And so I won't say I wasn't a little bit alarmed, but I had every confidence that, knowing that that came from the White House. I know that the Department of Defense takes this, the rule of law and the law of warfare really seriously. So I was happy to hear the confirmations coming out of the Department of Defense that, of course, we will follow the law of war. And to hit cultural sites when they're without any kind of military necessity, reasoning for doing it is just against the law of war.
Yeah, well, it is good news that that got walked back and that, in fact, the United States of America doesn't behave in ways like that. And we can be thankful, I think. So, and for your work as well, Major Corey Wegener, and for joining me on the air this morning on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Alrighty, and safe travels to Vermont tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
Alrighty, we're going to take a brief break for some CBS News at the top of the hour, a couple words from our sponsors, and back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and we're going to be talking in this hour, a few minutes from now, I think, with Dan Richardson. He is our legal analyst, really, on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and he is a frequent guest and someone we really enjoy having on the show. But first, I wanted to get a little more discussion going here about the Iowa caucuses, which were, I see a headline here in the USA Today. It says, a total mess. Caucusing is over, but Iowa still doesn't have a winner. And we have somebody from Axios Online News Service, really terrific, well-written, very tightly written online news service, Axios, with us. I believe it's Steph Kite on the line this morning. Good morning, Steph.
Good morning.
And thank you so much for joining me. Are you in Iowa as we speak?
I'm not in Iowa right now. It's not my turn to be there on the ground, but I've been covering what's going on there and been in touch with one of my colleagues who is there.
I see. Okay. And so is there anything new to report in the last couple of hours? I've been kind of busy here on the air, and so I was trying to figure out, is anything at all resolved yet this morning, or is it still, as USA Today puts it, a total mess?
It is still a total mess at this point. Basically, all that we know is that there was some kind of a coding issue with the app that was being used to transmit the results and the votes from the caucuses. And something went down there, which then had a cascading issues effect that has delayed our ability to see the results. And Iowa Democratic Party has claimed that the results haven't been changed and the data was still accurately reported, but it's just an issue of getting that public. But of course, there's still lots of concerns and questions about whether the results can still be trusted. And we're certainly seeing President Trump on Twitter this morning blaming Democrats for not being able to get their stuff together and make this a smooth process in Iowa.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture, I guess. It certainly is something which, if you were a presidential candidate hoping that maybe a strong showing or even a win in Iowa was going to give you momentum heading into New Hampshire in the following primaries and caucuses, this has got to be a big hiccup, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, Iowa is so important to so many presidential candidates, as it's often predicted who would win the nomination, who would, in some cases, who would go on to win the White House. And, you know, we've seen kind of pushback from Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who was one of the only candidates to kind of claim victory or kind of boast about how well he was doing last night before we got any official results. And there's been some pushback on his optimism and his declaring victory last night, although the early signs seemed to look like seemed to show that he was doing well. But again, we have no final results at this point.
Yeah, and no way to tell, you know, any of the other candidates. I mean, if people have a favorite, let's say your favorite, I don't know, is Amy Klobuchar or Bernie Sanders or any of the others, everybody's in the same boat. You're all looking at this and saying, nah, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's looking at this thing. It's really hard to tell, and it just calls into question. Of course, this is an election where we're already nervous about meddling and election hacking and all these issues that have become more important as we head into this cyber hacking world. And then to have the very first caucus, the very first time that we're voting on Democratic candidates that have a technological failure is really disheartening to a lot of people and just puts the whole race in question for many people. And it's also raising questions about whether Iowa, which is, you know, a small, predominantly white state, should still be the first in the nation, should keep its first in the nation status when it comes to presidential elections and caucuses.
Well, there were already a lot of legitimate questions about that, and I don't think Iowa has helped itself in this instance, has it?
No, it certainly has not. As you said, there was already a lot of discussion about whether there were different states that would be better off to be the first state that better represent the nation as a whole as Iowa used to in the past. And so this is already a discussion among political pundits and people online. But then to have this failure just increases the concern. And it's interesting because Iowa Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley, as well as the Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, actually defended the state's caucus system this morning, sending out a statement saying, you know, that this is an important thing, that it starts in Iowa, and kind of defending the whole thing. And, you know, almost similarly to Trump, pointing to Democrats as the people to blame, not Iowa and its own election system.
You know, I've had my suspicions about caucuses as a way to do this all along, frankly, and so maybe I'm biased on this, but I really do think that just watching the process unfold, even if it appeared in the early hours of last evening maybe to be working normally, watching these little crowds of people gather in different parts of a school gymnasium and then sort of break up and reform and so on and so forth, I was saying to myself, is this any way to run a presidential election? I mean, you know, whatever happened to the secret ballot in America? And I mean, the whole thing just strikes me as kind of too weird, frankly. Pardon my,
you are certainly not alone. You know, I was following along on Twitter and talking to people last night, and that was certainly an ongoing concern and question to see this. It's kind of crazy, as you said, to see people forming groups in different corners of the room and then having to pick someone else to form. Like, it was almost like teams deciding who they wanted to go with and this in-person strategizing. And some people would say that that's something that's actually helpful, that to actually be in person talking with people face-to-face, eye-to-eye, actually has its plus sides. But it does raise this question of how do you accurately count? It seems susceptible to miscounting and maybe just being biased in the environment that you're in and depending on where you're caucusing. So it has been interesting to see everyone really see this play out, see how strange it can be, the caucusing system, and then to have the results delayed like this. And, of course, there were new rules that the Iowa Democratic Party enacted this year so that they could be more transparent. So we actually had more reporting along the way of this caucus system than we typically have in the past. So there were lots of moving parts, lots of new things, and then the app, so there's a lot going on, and then to have this all kind of crumble at the end of the day has caused a lot of concern and annoyance from people.
Yeah, I think there may be a new state slogan for New Hampshire or something, which could be like something like New Hampshire, hey, at least we can count. Or I don't know. I think New Hampshire is kind of a weird case now that we're beating up on early presidential contests, because I've noticed, I did a little research recently, and New Hampshire has a very, very strong regional bias toward New Englanders. Henry Cabot Lodge won the Republican primary in New Hampshire in 1960. And since then, you may not even recall names like Edmund Muskie, 1972, won the Democratic primary in New Hampshire. His claim to fame was that he was from Maine. Paul Tsongas won in 1992. His claim to fame was that he was from Lowell, Mass., about 30 miles down the Merrimack River from Manchester, New Hampshire. So I think basically in New Hampshire, if you look at the history, it's really kind of I can think of one time where a New Englander actually lost in New Hampshire. That was Howard Dean in 2004. He lost to John Kerry from Massachusetts. So if you look at New Hampshire, I think basically you've got to be a Red Sox fan to win there. These weird little anomalous states starting off this process here. Is anybody taking a serious look at this?
I mean, I think people still do take a serious look at this. And I think, as you pointed out, there are certainly biases and state and region biases when it comes to these kinds of caucuses. But historically, these states have been important to getting a feel for where the Democrat Party stands, where the Republican Party stands, what kind of candidates are doing well. But of course, this won't necessarily decide the nominee, especially as the U.S. as a whole, as demographics shift and as who we are as a nation changes, there will be other factors that come into play. And I think we could see states like Iowa and New Hampshire maybe becoming less significant in determining who will be the Democratic nominee or who will be the Republican nominee in other election years. But that's something that we're certainly watching at Axios, something that we're waiting to see how important these states really are at the end of the day. And of course, we're still really early in the 2020 cycle, and it's certainly something that we're watching and could ultimately lead to a change up of how we do caucuses and how we do primaries and how we do presidential election years.
Well, let's keep an eye on it. And I think Axios is going to be a great help to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV going forward. I really appreciate you joining me this morning, and thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you.
All righty. And Dan Richardson is my next guest. He's our legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show, and back after a brief hiatus. And Dan, congratulations on your recent appointment to the Montpelier City Council.
Oh, thank you.
And we had a brief pause there in your appearances here on the Dave Graham Show, but we're glad to have you back. And we wanted to check in with you about a couple of recent Vermont Supreme Court decisions, and then maybe if we have time, we can get back to the other trial that's been going on recently. That would be this little impeachment trial happening in Washington. So tell us, first off, what's news with the Vermont Supreme Court?
Well, you know, it's the beginning of the year, and a couple of decisions have come out. As normal, most of the cases involve criminal appeals, but there are a couple interesting civil cases. One is the joint petition of Champlain Broadband LLC, which was appealed from the PUC, which is the Burlington Telecom case, and hopefully the last installment of the Burlington Telecom case.
The last chapter of a long and sad novel.
Right. And so for those who don't necessarily remember the beginning of this, what happened was, you know, back under the Bob Kiss administration, Burlington got the idea of creating their own telecom to provide internet and cable service. And whenever you create a cable, it's a regulated entity. You have to go to the Public Utilities Commission and get what they call a certificate of public good, which Burlington did. But they were required under both their charter and their certificate of public good not to use taxpayer funds. And taxpayers were not intended to be put on the hook for this. But by 2007, it became clear that taxpayers were being put on the hook to the tune of about $16.9 million. There was an investigation that followed. I think a lot of this ended up bringing down the Kiss administration, you know, when re-election time came around. And in 2014, Burlington Telecom was sold to this Blue Water Group that was essentially a group of creditors, and the city was a co-owner. And in that case, that's where they really resolved a lot of the old CPG violation issues. And what this case was is that since then, that was really sort of an interim position, and ultimately they were seeking to sell it to another entity, which in this case was Champlain Broadband LLC, which is a new owner of Burlington Telecom, and they needed approval from the Public Utilities Commission, which they sought and obtained. There was a group of citizen interveners that sought to stop this, or at least put on conditions that Champlain Broadband repay the city taxpayers, because, you know, ultimately the taxpayers of the city of Burlington were, you know, did have to fork over $16.9 million, which they're not going to ever get back as part of subsidizing Burlington Telecom, which is not what was intended. And so these interveners were seeking to involve that. But the Supreme Court decision, both the PUC and the Supreme Court said, too little, too late. It's over. We're not going to retroactively put these conditions onto Champlain Broadband when they weren't put on to the Blue Water 2014 decision. You're effectively stopped from doing that. And so as a result, you know, the citizens of Burlington, you know, have that bill to foot, or have already footed it, but will not receive a recovery from it. But ultimately, the court and the PUC are looking to a larger public good, which is that Burlington Telecom lives to provide cable access for another day.
Very interesting. Now, the city of Burlington, I seem to remember the $16.9 million being talked about as sort of a bridge loan or something like that from the city to the Burlington Telecom. And there was always, if I have this right, there was always sort of a at least an implied promise that it's going to be paid back at some point. Basically, we are now 10 years out or more from all of that and saying, eh, never mind.
Right. Well, you know, it was actually fairly interesting when it broke. What had happened was they were kind of bridge loans. The city of Burlington has – so Burlington Telecom itself was not a separate entity. It was essentially an enterprise division of the city of Burlington. It was the city itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way Burlington finances worked at the time was that Burlington had a pool of money at any given time. They are their own bank. And so if you're a department or division of the city of Burlington and you need money to fund your project and your tax funds or revenue haven't come in, you borrow from the city itself and then you have to repay a certain that amount plus interest. And so what but there's no promissory notes. It's sort of an internal – it was an internal process at the time. And it made sense because, you know, Burlington would sit on this pile of money. They'd use it internally and they'd avoid the interest charges or bank fees that a lot of smaller municipalities incur because they have to borrow in anticipation of taxes. But the problem here, of course, was that the $16.9 million, and it didn't come at one time. It came over time to fund these things because telecoms are more expensive than I think even the smartest of us realize to fund and to finance and to install. And so as a result, you know, I think they were constantly sort of borrowing. It became a little bit of a pyramid scheme, hoping to, you know, well, we'll repay it, but we have to give a little more. And as a result, you know, this huge amount of money piled up, and then it became public. And once it became public, you know, it there was no way to sort of keep it swept under the rug and repay it slowly over time.
Yeah,
it became a crisis. And so, you know, at that point in time, you know, it was clear. And it was in 2014 when Burlington Telecom really had to figure out how is this going to work. And, you know, I think there was a choice that they had to make. It was either something where taxpayers were going to be shorted, but the greater good of keeping the utility alive would happen, or they'd have to sell it off piecemeal and the taxpayers would get probably pennies on a dollar.
Now, the original story of Burlington Telecom, I mean, the motivation for its creation, from what I recall, was that there was general dissatisfaction by many people in the city with the incumbent providers of cable and television and other telecom services in the city. And there was a general, I think, thought that, at least among the people who wanted to create Burlington Telecom, that we could set up a public sector entity effectively and do this better or cheaper or more consumer friendly, however you want to describe it. And this particular story of that attempt essentially ends up not working out. It's back in private sector hands now, right?
It is. It is. And cable's interesting. You know, we don't get to choose our electrical providers. You mm-hmm. know, if you live in Montpelier or Burlington, you have Green Mountain Power. If you live, you know, in East
Burlington,
Montpelier,
Burlington Electric Department.
Burlington. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting.
Which is a public sector entity.
It is.
And so.
But I mean, you don't get to choose. If you're in Burlington, you don't get to say, "I want Green Mountain Power instead of Burlington
right.
Electric."
You
have to live with that. Whereas cable can be competitive. Cable, even though it's regulated, still if Comcast or if Charter or if Burlington Telecom says we're going to set up in this area and they're allowed to do so, you know, they can compete even if Comcast or Charter is already there. And so it's an interesting competitive model in the regulated utility industry to begin with. But yeah, this was a logical extension of, I think, some of the progressive policies that Burlington had been pursuing really since Senator Sanders was mayor. You know, and through him, Clavel and Kiss, you know, there was this push to, well, if private sector can do it, public sector can do it. And in this case, it proved not to be so true.
Yeah. There are some counterexamples, though, around the country, if I recall correctly, of municipalities actually setting up municipal telecom services that have worked. Is that right?
Yeah. It could certainly work. I mean, part of it is, you know, the big expense on telecoms are often the infrastructure, you know, the pole rates you have to pay, the laying of fiber optic cable, you know, the maintaining of said systems.
Switches and,
all of them to make sure that, you know, the home garden television channel gets to your set that evening.
That's right. And if it doesn't, big trouble.
Oh, lots of complaints.
Yep.
You know, and you know, there are – so there's this expense of infrastructure, and if you can make that work, if for some reason there's either existing infrastructure that you can tap into or there's other types of you know, utility services that you can use, it can be cost effective. But, you know, this is the difficulty of creating your own telecom, is that you have to create your own cable network.
And meanwhile, elsewhere in Vermont, there actually still are efforts to create telecoms, expand telecom systems. These are the what are now called, I think it's communications union districts, I believe.
Right.
Things like EC Fiber, and there are efforts to bring something like that here to central Vermont and up to the Northeast Kingdom. Are they taking any lessons learned here in the Burlington Telecom case, and are they going to avoid any similar pitfalls?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think both the Public Service Department as well as any of these entities have looked carefully at the Burlington Telecom issue, because it was such a mess in the end of it. You know, cable television is an interesting thing. If you think about telephones have started to go the way of the dodo, which is that landlines are not as necessary or as ubiquitous as they were even 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
And if you think about cable television, fewer and fewer people are using cable television. They're streaming. They're going online.
Yep.
And now it's really about laying good, reliable fiber optic networks so that you can deliver fast internet download and streaming speeds. And that's the real challenge. And in Vermont, it's a particular challenge, as with all things, in getting it to the people, because there's a lot of miles that you have to travel and string cable to get to some houses in Vermont.
Customers per mile, it tends to be a low number here, certainly lower than in some New York City high-rise apartment building. And so if you're AT&T or you're Verizon or you're one of the other big telecom companies, just in terms of ripeness of market, you're going to go to Vermont probably after you're going to go to some big city and it's high-rise apartment buildings, right?
Absolutely. And, I at this point, all the sort of low-hanging fruit has been plucked. I mean, the easy places like Burlington or Montpelier or Rutland or any of the concentration of population, Chittenden County, have been hit. We're trying to get now an EC Fiber, and these other entities are trying to hit these very sort of low number per mile households.
Well, wishing them luck. Let's go to a bottom of the hour break with some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show. My guest is Dan Richardson. Welcome your phone calls, 244-1777 after the break, folks. We'll be back.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back. My guest is Dan Richardson. He's our legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And really appreciate Dan donating his time here to the show and providing us some excellent thinking about the law in Vermont and how it plays out in both our local court system, Vermont Supreme Court, et cetera, as well as sometimes on the national scene. I think in a little bit we're going to get to we're going to maybe talk a little bit about the impeachment trial that's been going on in Washington. But first, I wanted to invite you, Dan, to tell us about, I think you have another case here that's been up in front of the Supreme Court of considerable interest here.
Sure. Well, this one is actually, I think, interesting. I brought forward, it's a attorney disciplinary case. And the way attorneys are regulated in the state of Vermont and in most states is through the Vermont Supreme Court, and effectively self-disciplined by as a profession. So, You know, there's an office of professional of disciplinary counsel that makes sure that if people violate ethical rules, they're prosecuted, and the Supreme Court is the ultimate adjudicator for whether somebody should lose their license to practice or be suspended or reprimanded or any other penalty that they impose. And this one involved a lawyer down in the southern part of the state. She had joined a firm, but she had brought a case with her that involved her wife, and the what happened was she settled it, and the firm wanted a share. And this touches upon probably, you know, if you think about why are attorneys disciplined in the state of Vermont, the number one reason is often trust fund accounts, which is that attorneys hold funds for their clients. And when they mess up on that, those are ethical violations, and those are the most common ethical violations. But the next one seems to be coming up, and what this case involves is contingency fees and how those work. And there's a real problem with that, which is, you know, most lawyers or a lot of lawyers work on an hourly basis. You know, if you hire me, we sign a retainer agreement. I charge per the hour. I send you my bills every month, and you pay them. And if you have a disagreement with them, you tell me, and we work it out in kind of the same way a tradesperson would, time and materials kind of thing. But lawyers can also bill versus as contingency fees, which is they take no money up front, they take no money as the case goes on, but when the case settles, they take a third or up to 40% depending on where the case settles and when it settles. But these are you know, these are difficult and they're tricky. And there was a Supreme Court case about a year ago that involved someone who didn't, an attorney who didn't get a contingency fee signing, settled the case, took his contingency fee, and was sued by his client because the client said there was no contingency fee agreement and you only did a few hours worth of work. So you shouldn't get a third of $1 million. You should get a few thousand dollars. In this case, what happened was she settled the case and her firm said, we want a third. And she said, I'm not giving you a third. This was a family matter. I'll give you $8,000. And they didn't resolve it. And the attorney took the check, the settlement check from her firm, deleted all mention of receiving the check and brought it home. And the firm said, where's the check? And she said, well, it's not here. And she effectively lied, the firm and of her split and went different ways. But her dishonesty in dealing with the firm and dealing with the check, the Supreme Court says that's a violation of Rule 8.4, which is requires a lawyer to be honest. And so that dishonesty, because she basically didn't want to share a third of the settlement that if she didn't share, would come to her family directly. So there was a conflict of interest there. And she was dishonest about it rather than negotiating.
So the firm then that hires her and she comes first day of work and she's already got basically a piece of business in progress.
Right.
What this sounds like. What's the norm there? Should the new firm say that's your business and you finish that up and we'll bring you on full from now on? All of your cases are partly ours and we're a joint enterprise. Or should they say, you know, you're working here now. Anything you do, including stuff you have left over from previously, is partly ours.
Well, that's a good question, and that's often what lawyers, when they join firms, will negotiate, which is to say, you know, if I've been working on a case for 10 years and I'm now in the last 6 months of this case and it's moving towards settlement, and I join a new firm, I may very well say, look, I want you to understand, I'll give you some money, but you're not getting a third of this because the bulk of the work has already been done and it's my money. And if you want me to join the firm, great, but you're not getting this third. And you can make that arrangement. You can make that contract.
But she didn't do that, is the allegation here. Okay.
She didn't make that clear. And then, you know, and as the case recounts, she basically approached her firm in the middle of mediation saying, how much are you going to take out of this because I'm settling this? And they're like, well, how much are you taking? And she said, well, it's family, so I'm taking zero. And they're like, well, we'll take a third.
And the other wrinkle here is that it sounds like that she was not just an attorney representing a plaintiff in this case, she was actually the plaintiff herself?
Well, she wasn't the plaintiff. It was her wife that was the plaintiff.
Okay.
And but, you know, it's family. And it's funny, I just represent myself on a real estate matter, and I was talking to the attorney on the other side, and he said, are you representing yourself? And I said, I am. He said, you know what they say? And I said, I know. I've got a fool for a client. He said, no. He said, you don't. It's a good way to save money, but it's different. And it's true.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true. You know, things that wash off your back professionally when it's your case are different. And that's why people hire lawyers in the first place, is that they don't want to have to deal with these issues because there's an emotional component to it. They need somebody who can be professional, distant, and, you know,
detached,
disinterested.
Yeah.
And give objective information. And so in a case like this, you know, it was inherently loaded. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, the mistake was just as you zeroed in on at the beginning. She should have worked this out, and she didn't. And instead, what she did was she snuck out the funds. Now, what's interesting about this case, and she was suspended for 15 days, mm-hmm. lost her ability to practice for 15 days, which seems like a fairly minor thing. But it is, it's a, you know, it's a very public, it's a matter of public record. It's in Ray Stacey Adamatsky. You know, 2020 Vermont 7, it's a public record, this case.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who looks her up is going to have this. And so it is a spot on her record, as well as the fact that, you know, in some respects, nobody was technically harmed. It wasn't a client. This was an internal matter. But it shows how seriously the Supreme Court takes these issues about fees and about how we handle each other, even in an intra-office dispute.
Boy, that's, I remember a case 20 years ago or more in Vermont where an attorney was in trouble with the disciplinary board, the professional conduct board, I think it was called at the time, and was going to be suspended, and had a you know, a dozen or more pending cases at the time, and got a friend who was also an attorney to basically take over the cases.
Right.
And now, you know, some of the cases start to settle, or there, you know, I think there was even a jury verdict in one of them or something. And the question was, you know, how do you split up the proceeds from those cases between the suspended lawyer who attracted the business initially and who worked on it some,
right.
And then and with the still working lawyer who's taken over these cases, what do you? I don't need you to comment on this specific case.
Sure.
You might guess who I'm talking about here, but what should happen in a case like that?
Well, I think first and foremost, the client should be made whole. So if there's any damage that was suffered to the client's case as a result of the attorney's malpractice to begin mm-hmm. with, that's the first remedy, and the court and disciplinary system is geared towards that. And I can tell you that, in fact, the Vermont Bar Association has a fund of last resort, a defalcation fund that, you know, is available to clients who've been hurt by attorneys. So there's that. That's the first level. And then, you know, the second is, you know, you'd have to look at, was the harm related to the case in such a way that it would otherwise be inequitable or unfair to give the attorney that committed the disciplinary issues some of these fees. And once you've gone through that analysis, if at the end the client has not been harmed, you know, the discipline, the bad behavior is not tied to this case or this particular fee, then yeah, there's ways of working that out, which is that, you know, the attorney who originated it may take some percentage of a fee that's effectively fair.
And again, I think it sounds to me like the key thing, and it's common sense really. I don't think you have to be a lawyer to figure this out, but basically sit down and talk it through ahead of time.
Exactly.
Figure out exactly where you're going with this. Preferably put it in writing so there's no dispute about, you know, who
agreed
to what.
It's a classic example of the shoemaker's children who go without, who go barefoot. you know, we as lawyers are just as guilty and as bad of not making these type of contracts that we tell our clients to over and over again. Make these arrangements, make it clear. And that's a basic rule of contracts I always tell my clients, is that, you know, make a contract while everybody's happy, everybody's at the table, and everybody's in agreement, because mm-hmm. then you're going to get consensus. You're going to be able to create a contract and agreement that reflects everybody's thinking, so that later on when you start to split apart and you start to go different ways, you have that contract in place that can guide you in that process. And so, because you're not going to come to a consensus and agreement once you've started fighting and arguing.
Yeah, the these legal discipline cases are sometimes really quite fascinating. I think a couple of the clusters of them I've seen over time in Vermont as a reporter, could have been a novel or something.
A
lot of personalities involved, and large moving forces in the state's judicial system, and so on and so forth. So it's fascinating stuff. But wanted to focus, broaden the lens here a little bit, and just get your thoughts about the latest doings in Washington with this impeachment trial of President Trump. And I guess my first threshold question here, Dan Richardson, is can you have a trial without evidence and witnesses, or what do you have?
Well, you have an existential dilemma, and possibly a Dada art project. But
I had not heard it referred to as a Dada art project before, but okay.
I mean, it just raises a question. I mean, the trial itself has certain connotations, and this goes back to what, you know, we've talked about before, is the fact that while we call it a trial, while it has some trappings of a judicial process, you know, you have a guy in a robe sitting atop a bench in front of everybody, it's not a trial. It's not a judicial proceeding. It is very much a political process. And so by that respect, they can set the rules. And I think, so can they do what they're doing? Yeah, they can. But
could it fairly be called a show trial?
It could be called that, or it could be called a process that, you know, lacks substance and, you know, lacks the trappings that, you know, there's a reason why we have court and certain procedures in court, and that's to ensure a fair trial, ensure that we touch upon the substance of the issues. I mean, the right to cross-examination is a classic right, not because it's fancy and fun and makes for good television, but because it, you know, over the years we've found, in the centuries, we found that it gets at the truth. That if you test people's evidence, if you test people's testimony by allowing the other side to ask questions, you can often get at some of the truth of the matter. And so by not having witnesses, by not having any process, basically just hearing a recitation of it, it's not a trial. It becomes a political process, and it reflects to a certain extent the political realities of the moment. And so, you know, you get these senators that are coming out, you know, someone like Lamar Alexander, who says, he did what he did. We don't need witnesses to prove it. They've proven their case. There's no doubt factually. But, you know, I'm not going to vote for witnesses, and I'm not going to vote to impeach because, you know, of basically the politics. And so, you know, that's in some ways the way the process is designed to work, is that the political process and the politicians that are intended to follow up with that process act like creatures of that they are.
And the fact that the House has not brought and appears to not be planning to bring charges related to the payoff from campaign finance funds to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Michael Cohen, the co-conspirator in that episode, is in jail.
Right.
The other co-conspirator, individual one, is in the White House. That says to me that maybe there's something that could be pending there, but appears to not be. And what do you make of that? I mean, are you at all worried that going into future administrations that various presidents will think, well, I can do this too. There's no penalty.
Yeah. No, anytime that there are these instances, and I think this is the real danger, is that it does set precedents, and it does set, you know, it does set the sort of bar for behavior or for expectations. I saw somewhere posting around basically that if, and this is a sort of dream scenario, that, you know, if the Democrats should flip the Senate and get 67 seats, they can immediately impeach and remove Donald Trump without without having any sort of trial based on the Republican Senate's precedent. And it technically that's true. Realistically, that's an impossible scenario, because I can't imagine a scenario where they would reelect Trump and, you know, turn
pick up
over 67 the Senate.
Seats,
exactly.
Yeah.
No. You know, I mean, that's just silly. But it does indicate that, you know, people do think that way. And it's a physics of politics. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Let's bring in a caller. Fred's on the line from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, is it possible to prevent impeachment from becoming abuse?
Is it possible?
It seems to me. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to repeat the question. Is it possible to prevent impeachment from becoming abused?
Yeah.
Do you think it's been abused here in this case?
You asking me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
You don't think there should be any punishment? I mean, the president can't be charged with a crime, according to the Justice Department, so can't do that.
But the Congress or the House of Representatives can impeach any president they want.
So
they can just do it. That's what they did.
Okay.
They just came up and say, we don't like this guy, we're going to impeach him.
Well, I think they have a little more reason than that, at least what they describe. So you don't buy the idea that he basically threatened Ukraine with a cutoff of military aid if they didn't produce dirt on the Bidens? Is that?
Yeah, right. They could say anything. He abused Congress. That's what they could say.
Okay, well,
he abused his power.
Well, do you believe that the story about Ukraine is true? Which Lamar Alexander apparently believes, and Lisa Murkowski, a Republican, apparently believes, and some of the other Republicans are saying, yeah, he did this stuff, but you don't think he did?
It's too difficult. I mean, I would say I don't believe he did, right? That's what my politics are. This whole thing is politics.
But wait. Why do you let your politics determine what the facts are in your own mind?
Yeah, but that's the problem. What are the facts? You know, you got your facts. I've got my facts.
I disagree wholeheartedly.
You know damn well that beauty's in the eyes of the beholder.
We're not talking about beauty here. We're talking about, did he make the phone call to Zelensky? We're talking about, what did he say on the phone call? We're talking about what kind of threats were made, and what are you going to withhold? What am I going to withhold if you don't do what I want you to, et cetera? There are facts to be found here, Fred, and to say that there aren't any facts to be found here, I think is just will really lead us to a very, very bad place in American politics.
So basically what's going to happen, here's what's going to happen, and you'll have to agree with me, I think, that the voters are going to determine the fate of the president.
Yeah.
So why can't we let the voters determine the fate of the president? If the voters want a crook to be a president, that's what's going to happen. If they don't, they need to be kicked out.
It does bring back the H.L. Mencken line, that in a democracy, the voters get the kind of government they deserve.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But, I guess I would share Dave's concern that, it's one thing to make a decision such as Lamar Alexander did or Lisa Murkowski did that has a political bent to it that says, okay, the facts are what they are, but we don't think this is worthy of impeachment. But to deny the nature of the facts, I think it's very well established that, this president did threaten and did take action to withhold funds from Ukraine that had been approved by Congress, which he doesn't have the authority to do. And he did so for political gain in his reelection campaign. Now, whether that's an impeachable offense, that's where people start to divide along political spectrum, but to deny that that happened, I think, is to some extent refuting reality.
Fred, if a Democrat did what Dan just described, exact same set of facts, but it were a Democratic president, do you think that president would deserve to be impeached?
If there was a Republican House of Representatives, he probably would be.
Yeah, do you think that would be a good thing?
No.
You don't?
Oh.
Okay. Well, at least you're even-handed about it, so I appreciate that. Hey, Fred, I got to go. Thank you for the call. I really appreciate it. Dan, I'm just wondering, but I would say to folks, by the way, there are some people who are essentially calling the show every day, and I got to urge people to maybe spread it out a little bit because we try to let other folks have a turn to jump in here to the conversation from time to time. And I don't want to mention any names, but I'm just reminded very recently about this issue here. So, I'm directing this at some of the folks out there who may wonder why I don't always pick up the call as it comes in, because
sure.
If I already heard from a person, it's only Tuesday and I'm hearing from somebody, I'm thinking, this is going to be five calls this week, or what's the what's the deal?
Sure.
Anyway,
well, so it's an interesting conversation. I mean, I think people feel passionately about it. And, you know, the last caller, I think, expresses some of the concern that we, you know, that is evolving in politics, which is a bit of identity tied up into politics on a national level in a way that I don't think we've seen in at least in recent history. I mean, I think you can look to past precedent, but, you know, it's a sports analogy, which is, you know, the 49ers lost the Super Bowl. My brother happens to be a huge 49ers fan, has for decades. Mm-hmm. He didn't stop liking the 49ers because they lost or because they made mistakes in the game that cost them the game.
Yep.
You know, if anything, his loyalty drives that much deeper. And I think we find, you know, I see it at least anecdotally, you know, that people start to identify partisanly with their politics. And it's not about the substance. It's not about the issues. It's about the identity. You know, this is my president or this is my congressperson. This is my party.
I really wish it were different. I wish that we could get back to a time when the facts actually mattered. And you know, if a Democrat or, you know, anybody gets elected and does some of the things this president has done, I would be fully in support of of holding this president accountable of any party. And that's the bottom line for me. That's why I think the facts do matter. It's very important to get to the bottom of them and follow them where they logically lead. Hey, as it happens, we are about the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And I really appreciate Dan Richardson coming in this morning. Thanks so much, Dan.
My pleasure.
And we are going to call it a day on this program and be back tomorrow for another edition. Meanwhile, stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and have a great afternoon, everybody.